Hello, namaste, sat sri akal, salamu alaikum, and welcome to the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the people, and the culture of the world. Nobody can really fail to notice Brexit at the moment. It's the elephant in the room, no matter what you're talking about. You turn on the radio, you watch the TV, you read a paper, you go on social media, everybody's got an opinion on Brexit. What's going to come next? Who knows? But certainly the MPs don't seem to know any more than we do. One thing's for sure, to some extent, maybe we would now be just marching straight out of the EU with a no-deal Brexit, had it not been for a certain lady who took the government to court shortly after the referendum and demanded that we retain our democracy and that Parliament would have a vote on every decision. That lady, who I'm guessing I certainly hadn't heard of her before and you probably hadn't heard of her before, is Gina Miller. And I've got Gina on the show today. Gina, hello, how are you doing?
Good. Hi there, Martin. Lovely to be on the show. And yes, look forward to having a chat with you.
It really is great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for giving me the time today. So, as you know, what I want to do is, you know, we're not going to delve deeply into the political situation at the moment. I think everybody's sick and tired of Brexit.
And not only that, I don't think anybody can predict 1 hour, much less 1 day.
Exactly. Anything could happen after this interview, but it's certainly good timing to be talking to you. What I'm interested in and what I'm interested in sharing with our audience is who Gina Miller is, what makes her tick, because certainly whichever side of the fence you are, whether you're a no-deal Brexiter, a deal Brexiter or a Remainer, nobody can doubt that what you did was, you know, it took a lot of courage and a lot of hard work. You know, most people wouldn't have a clue how to take the government to court and win. So I'm really interested in who Gina Miller is. So I know that you were born in British Guyana and you stayed there until the age of 10. And as everyone who listens to the Culture Pot knows, I like to ask my guests to describe their childhoods to me because that tells me a little bit about what made them into the person that they are. I think one good way of starting this interview from here, Gina, would be, I know you've sent me your song list of 10 songs. So let's start with your first song, which is Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. You tell me a little bit about that song.
It's when I choose or I say this song, most people are quite surprised. But it to me, it just fills me with joy because going back to my childhood, but when I was a young woman and I had my first child, I was quite young. I was 24, 25. And she unfortunately was born with special needs because, you know, our NHS in the 70s, 80s was actually on its knees. People forget that. But there weren't enough midwives and health sisters. So she was starved of oxygen at birth. But despite her disabilities, music has played a really important part in her life and has been a great way for me to not just connect with her, but allow her to be the best she could be. And this song, Lust for Life, was a song that we used to jump around the sofa. It was the one song that would get her moving, excited, giggling, you know, just so full of energy and laughter. So for me, it embodies her joy. And the beat in the song is extraordinary. It's just full of energy and upbeat. And that's why I love it.
Great. Well, here it is. This is Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. So that was Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. You're listening to Martin on the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. And today's guest is Gina Miller. Thank you very much again, Gina, for being on the show.
My pleasure.
So I'd like to ask you about life growing up in British Guyana. I know that your father was a pretty important figure and ended up becoming the Attorney General. And I know that you ended up leaving British Guyana at the age of 10, I think, to come over to the UK. But if you could tell me a little bit about those formative years, about your parents and about the main influences on your life, that'd be fantastic, Gina.
Yeah, I have to say, Martin, I think, like many people, the person I am today is due to my parents and my upbringing. And I had the most special of upbringings in that you mentioned my father. Yes, he became Attorney General, but at the age of 14, he couldn't really read or write. He was serving petrol, you know, and collecting coins, saved them all up, put himself through night school, then came to the UK to study law. And even at that time, I knew his aspiration was that if he ever had children, if he was ever fortunate enough, that he'd want them to experience a British education. And so, you know, that's, but I was fortunate in that I grew up mainly at his knee. I was very much my father's daughter, but he had the most extraordinary sense of caring for people, for using the law to right wrongs. He spent a lot of his career doing an awful lot of pro bono work because in British Guiana, and even now today, we have the death penalty. Wow. And there was a lot of racial civil war going on at the time. There is still a real sort of hotbed of underneath the surface of racial tensions. And that, I grew up in that, and he grew up in that. And there are so many ironies I've discovered in my life in that when I was coming towards 10 and my elder brother to 12, our country was in such a state, we had a dictator. And my father wasn't the leader, but he was instrumental in setting up an opposition party called the People's Progressive Party.
Okay.
Which, you know, was going to fight for people, was going to fight against the government and our dictatorship and politicians who just didn't have the people's best interests at heart. And the leader, a very young, charismatic young man called Rodney, was actually killed in a car bomb. And my parents discovered that we were then targets, our family. And so I was sent to the UK to be safe by my parents. But not only, it was sort of the final decision, but they'd always dreamt. You know, I grew up in a household where Britain was seen as, you know, some people say El Dorado is in Guiana, but actually we grew up thinking that Britain was El Dorado, that, you know, this is where you got the best of life, the best opportunities, the best education, the best principles and values, and you could, you know, go out into the world anywhere and make a real mark if you had experienced living and being educated in the UK. So, you know, my mother would have sort of the Queen's photograph on the wall. She collected Wedgwood china. You know, like many Commonwealth countries,
yeah,
we grew up with great reverence, of Britain and England. And as a young girl, I was an avid reader. So, you know, I read, even at the age of 10, I'd read Dickens, I'd read Bronte sisters. You know, I was so excited to come, but I didn't know later the true reason that my parents were actually sending me to the UK. So, you know, whilst I had the most extraordinary, upbringing, my father in my holidays, I'd go and watch him in court. He would come, and I had really, really long hair, and he would come and sit on the bench in the evening breeze, brush my hair, and tell me about what he did that day, about why he was defending this person and not that person. You know, he and I had a really special bond. My mother was a disciplinarian, but mm-hmm. my father had the most extraordinary heart for caring for other people. And as I say, I grew up at his knee, so I think everything I am today is due to his real sense of what's right and wrong that he impressed on me from a little girl, but also my mother. My mother was an eco-warrior before I think the phrase was even invented. You know, she said you have to care for everything you have today because it could be gone tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every tin had a place, every bit of string, you know, everything was valuable, every bag was kept. And again, that sense of discipline and not taking anything for granted is something I got from her. So I think between them, they were extraordinary people, and what they taught me and my siblings were invaluable.
Okay, Gina, that's really remarkable, by the way. I've loved your answer. It's given me a lot of insight, and I do have some further questions to delve into. But I thought, let's take another break with some music. Your next track is Sway With Me by Rosemary Clooney. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that before we go to it?
I just love the gentleness of this song. It just takes you, it just puts a smile on your face. It's got those undertones of a sort of a Latin influence. It's just, you can imagine yourself just swaying in the evening in a cool evening breeze. It reminds me of those evenings in Guiana, sitting in our lovely garden on the bench, and just I can hear the sound of the wind I can hear the sound in the music, and it just takes you away to somewhere else, this song.
And I believe it reminds you of something else, doesn't it?
Yes, and because of that sort of real sense of calm and serenity and also just happiness, it was the song that I chose as my wedding song. So my husband and I, it was the song we danced away when we got married in Goldeneye in Jamaica. So in the cool tropical breeze there, we swayed.
Brilliant. Okay, well, here it is. Sway With Me by Rosemary Clooney. So, Gina, that was Sway With Me, Rosemary Clooney. I'm sure that you had some nice memories there of your wedding, because you told me you'd played that on your wedding night. So, before we went to the song, you were telling me that about your parents, and I can already see how they've shaped you. You said that your mother was a disciplinarian. What did your mum do for a living?
She taught English, so I was brought up in a convent. I mean, in Guyana, as in South America, we have a long history, hundreds of years of brethren and nuns coming from Britain and Ireland and Wales to South America. So, you know, she was brought up very strictly by nuns, and then she became an English teacher herself. So I think her discipline came from her upbringing, and that's what she passed on.
I can definitely relate with that. My father was brought up in an orphanage by nuns, and they weren't soft. He ended up being a military policeman. I don't know which bit was more disciplinarian, the military police or the nuns. So we were saying when the song was playing and we were having a chat that obviously you weren't born Gina Miller, you were born Gina Nadira Singh.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily, I asked you straight out, you know, are you a Sikh? And you said to me there was quite a few influences in your family. So
yes, I mean, it's South America, I mean, Guyana is a very strange country because some people think of it as being part of the West Indies, but it's not. It was, as a geographic landmass, it broke away from Trinidad and joined onto South America. So it sits right in the middle of Venezuela, Suriname, Brazil, and then French Guiana. So which is now called Cayenne. So it's got really different influence. And actually, the population, it's six people with one nation. So and almost sort of equal numbers of the six people. So you've got the indigenous South American Indian Amerindian tribes and one other tribe. Then you've got quite a big Asian population, but then you've got a Chinese population, an African-influenced population, because it was also, because it's on the coast, it's where a lot of empires of the past landed and brought slaves. So, you know, you go all the way Dutch, back to the Dutch, to the Spaniards, to the conquistadors, to the British, to the French. They all landed. Dutch, you know, Guyana, the word Guyana is Dutch. It stands for land of many waters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these influences mean that, you know, I sometimes joke when people say to me, so what ethnicities are? And I say, well, melting pot, because, you know, it's sort of what we are. But I do have my father had a great reverence, because not only was he, before he became Attorney General, he was one of the most respected international crime lawyers. So he would travel around the world to Russia, to India, and I remember him coming back from India and saying that what we don't hear about in Guyana growing up at school, you know, it's interesting that he was saying this, you know, all those years ago, but we learned about sort of British history, but we didn't learn about sort of things like the Indian Empire or the extraordinary things that they had achieved or the Chinese Empire. You know, he felt that we should learn more about world history, not just British history. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up very much fascinated by that. So, you know, in our household, pretty unusually, in an English-speaking country with a really strong British influence, we still read the stories from Brahman. I still read about Buddhism. You know, my parents introduced all of that because they wanted me to have a real broad knowledge and understanding of different peoples and different cultures. So I grew up with all of that. So, you know, we would go and see Bollywood films sometimes. You know, my father loved the Bollywood films, the dancing, as obviously as a young girl, so did I. You know, and the pathos and emotion in so many of the old Hollywood films was something something that I grew up knowing about.
Well, I can definitely relate with that because I was educated by Christian Brothers and they taught me all about different religions. So it's no surprise that I ended up with my own show called The Culture Pot. I can also
relate.
It's
a great thing, isn't it? It's good to know and not to fear, that you know, because I think it's that fear of the unknown that makes people or can make people concerned and worried.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, Gina, I'm renowned on my interviews for putting my own input in. I'm quite happy to share. One of the things that always fascinates me is you get people who are obsessed with table manners, for example. Yeah. And it always amuses me because what might be considered to be perfectly acceptable, if not necessary, in one culture would be considered rude in another culture.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that ignorance is not, there's that old saying, isn't it? Ignorance is bliss. I don't think it is. We need to actually understand. If we had more understanding of each other's cultures, and then we would have more understanding. Full stop.
I think it gives people more freedom. I think that culture is a beautiful thing, and we should celebrate it. But once your culture becomes a prison that dictates your behaviours, then you're no longer living your own life. And that's one of the things that I love about this show. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to play your next track, but then I'd like to find out a little bit more about things like the food and musical influences as well that you may have been aware of as a child, if that's all right.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, of course.
So the next track that we're going to play is God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. Have you got anything you'd like to comment about that, Gina?
Yeah, so my elder brother and I, as I said, we were sent to the UK to be safe, and then things sort of went, got very complicated because our dictator then brought in currency control, so my parents couldn't support us financially. So at the age of, I was 13, my brother was 15, we were living on our own. I know it was illegal. My parents said to me, look, it won't be long, you've got to try and be brave. So we were, and we, you know, as children, you don't blame your parents, you just get on with it. And so my brother and I cooked up this idea that we would help our parents out by getting jobs. So I sort of walked down very bravely. I was at school in Sussex in a place called Eastbourne, a tiny place. Mm-hmm. And I walked into the Grand Hotel on the seafront there and sort of convinced them that I was 16 and got myself a chambermaiding job. And my brother in the local pub got a job washing up in the kitchen. So we earned a little bit of money. And it was on my 16th birthday, my brother saved up quite a bit of his money and bought me an album by Billie Holiday for my 16th birthday. And on that album was this song, God Bless the Child. And it just, my brother and I can vividly remember he and I just sitting there close to each other listening to it and just thinking it was just such a beautiful, beautiful song. So it's very special to me because of my brother.
Wonderful. These are great tracks, Gina. So here it is, God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. So, great. Welcome back to the show. If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Culture Pot with Martin Morrison, and today's guest is Gina Miller. And we've just played her last track, which was God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. So, Gina, we're going to be moving soon with you to the UK when you were 10 years of age. But before that, while we're still in British Guiana, there's a few things I want to ask you. And one of those things concerns how people were treated, because I know, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, the British did terrible things to the people in, for example, Zimbabwe, for example. How were people treated by the British in Guyana?
I think like many of the sort of countries that became independent to the sort of latter part of the empire, there was this idea of just the British just packed up and left, which leaves a country in chaos because there is no political infrastructure, there's no political class really, there is no the knowledge levels of running, you know, departments such as finance or the economy, you know, which is what the British were doing, and to just leave, left countries, many countries open to either despots taking over, or lack of infrastructure, lack of investment, and lack of actual talent to fill that in. So it's a sort of a irresponsible way to leave a place where you have dominated it, and you've populated it with people of influence who are from Britain. So, for example, I remember growing up that you drive sort of half a mile from where we lived, and there'll be there was a compound called Bel Air, which is where all the ambassadors lived, all the staff who worked in all the departments lived, and you know, they had their own compound, and it was of such a better standard of living than you know, the surrounding areas. And it was very, very much them and us. We are the masters and you're the locals type scenario. And you know, there was a lot of resentment about that. And I think there was also a lot of resentment that there seemed to be a lack of care about the fact that when British left, not only did they leave and take their people, they also took an awful lot of investment. So the inward investment stopped as well. So, you know, our biggest department store, for example, is called Booker's, and that went. And, you know, there was this, it was almost as though you were cut loose as a country. Okay. And that caused a huge amount of resentment.
And your parents are still there?
My father died in 2013, and my mother now actually lives in Britain because of her health. But they stayed. My father stayed there up until he died.
And what's the state of play over there now?
Well, now we've never been a particularly stable government, but now, unfortunately, to add to the confusion, there has been a huge discovery of oil. They think it's probably one of the biggest discoveries that's been made for decades, or so probably even a century. And that will bring a whole new level of exploitation and corruption. So I'm very fearful. But at the same time, one of the really positive things about it is that my father and our government were involved in what's called the carbon, you know, all the rules and laws around trading for carbon, so that you couldn't stop loggers and different people taking down or burning down our forests in return for money, so we keep the forest virgin. So that was something that he was involved in, which was a very positive move for our environment. So I'm very proud of him on many, many different levels.
That's brilliant, and you should be. On a lighter note then, with regards to Guyana, last question about Guyana really. I'm, you know, interested in different cultures, as you know, and I'm just wondering, how about food? Was there anything that you would eat as a young kid that was distinctively Guyanian?
Well, I think the thing is that we had such a variety because we've got so many different cultures. So, you know, I grew up with curries, but then I grew up with, rice and peas. I grew up with Jamaican influence food, or West Indian influence food, Indian influence food, Chinese food. I mean, we had so much variety, and it was just wonderfully delicious because we had so many fruits and vegetables. And so, you know, and the flora and fauna in the country was just extraordinary. I mean, actually, my mother, when she stopped being a teacher and became a mother full time, she actually was also a celebrated botanist, because she would go into the rainforest and get wild orchids and then bring them back to the city and graft them onto trees and make them more, if you like, domesticated orchids, which is such a term. The food and the flowers and the richness and the colour was just magical.
Wonderful. Okay. I think we should play your next track, which everybody knows this, and I certainly have my reasons for playing this one. No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley. What comments do you want to make about that?
I mean, everybody. I mean, I just, as I said, because we grew up with reggae music too, so it's just, it was such a richness of not just food and culture, but music as well, because we had so many different influences. And, you know, as a child, Bob Marley, we'd be running around the garden dancing to Bob Marley. No Woman, No Cry was one of my dad's favourites, again, coming back to him. But it was also years later when I was having my second child, my son, that my husband had put together a playlist to have in hospital. And it's pure coincidence, because it was one of my childhood, you know, wonderful songs I love so much. As he was arriving, No Woman, No Cry was playing on the playlist, and we just laughed. So instead, in the midst of my screaming and crying, I laughed.
Well, I've got a story for you, which I'll tell you off air. So here it is. That's No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley. Right, so that was No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley, and I've been having a right old chat with Gina about the birth of my son. I think everyone must have stories about the birth of their children, mustn't they, Gina?
Absolutely. I remember, I don't know if you've ever watched, there's a film called Maybe Baby, which is about, I think, you know, Ben Elton wrote it about having a child and going through IVF, because it can be quite comical. In all the pain and all the rest of it, you have to laugh. Like so many things in life. And I think, as you say, everybody's got a birth story or two.
Well, it's something I could talk about all day because my mother was a midwife as well. here we go. So we've done four songs now. So I'm thinking, let's get to the period of your life when you've come to the UK. So I like our chat to be very open, Gina. So it's over to you now, really, to tell me how life developed for you once you got to England. If the journey was particularly scary, you can talk about that. Just feel free to chat about it.
Well, when I, you know, as I said earlier, that I was so excited because we'd learned all the things about Britain, and I remember vividly being in the car when we landed, going sort of driving from Heathrow, going down to Eastbourne and thinking, but everything's grey. I'm thinking, this is not how it was supposed to be. I remember that. And I also remember that people didn't look as happy as I thought they were going to be because, you know, to me, as I said, they were in El Dorado. They were living in this amazing country, but they didn't seem to be as happy and smiling as much as the place I'd just come from. And so that struck me as, the sort of reservedness of people struck me as a young girl as being as questioning and curious as to why that would be. I think I grew. That was the thing I remember most once I arrived. But when I was here, the other thing is when my parents dropped me off, I was excited about them taking me. But actually, it had never really sunk in that they were going to leave me. So to suddenly, my parents to then leave, and for me to be in a country I didn't know, people speaking in a way I didn't, you know, very formally, in a school and a culture, nobody really who looks like me, very few at my school, and I felt alone. I mean, I felt really desperately alone. Luckily, my brother was, half a mile away at the sort of, you know, the boys' school of my school, but apart from that, you know, just sense of real loneliness. And I didn't feel upset or angry with my parents because they didn't do it because they didn't love me. I knew that. But it was just a sense of, right, you've got to be strong now. You've got to, you know, no time for tears, no time for emotion. Yes, you're on your own, but you're going to have to just be strong. And that's how I decided I would cope with that sense of loneliness, was by being strong, whatever that meant.
And you were also, were you sleeping in dormitories in the school, or were you going home?
Yes, no. So I was in a dorm with about three or four other girls. And there's one thing. So my mother, on the Sundays, we could go to church, or we could go to, I was brought up as a Catholic, so I would go, you know, to the Catholic church. And on Sundays, you could wear what they called musty, so your own home clothes, but you're with your school coat on over it. And I'd put a little dab of my mum. I don't know if you remember this as a man, but there was a perfume, Nina Rishi perfume, that had like a dove stopper, the shape of a dove bird on the top of it. And that was my mother's perfume. So to help me not feel homesick, she gave me a bottle of her perfume. And I'd put a little dab of that on, or I'd put it on my pillow at night if I was missing her. And it would take me back to her, that sense of connection through that sense of smell. The girls just playing pranks. I remember a few weeks after I moved in that I went to dab some of the perfume on one of our Sunday church visits and thinking, doesn't smell the same. And I discovered that they had poured it all out and filled it with water because they thought that was funny. But I still wouldn't show that they'd upset me. So I ran off to the toilets and cried my heart out into a towel, so that they couldn't hear me, but then came back. And I wouldn't let them see that they had upset me. And I think that's just how I've coped. So I'll show my emotions in when I'm on my own, and I'll cry my tears out, and I'll cry any sort of negativity or anxious moments out. But then in public, I'll be calm. And that's something I started doing from that time of being a little girl.
Well, that's certainly something that you've needed, no doubt, since you came into the public eye in 2016. You know, it's interesting, looking at how the Gina Miller story unfolds, I see very similar values to my own. For example, from your father and from your mother, this sense of justice. Being self-disciplined, I'm sure, because of your mother's disciplinary input. Being a communicator, because your mother was an English teacher, and having an interest in the legal mechanisms of law because of your father's occupation. And I can also see how, so far, life in Guyana, which itself is was a melting pot, as you've said, and then coming over and feeling isolated but just getting on with it in the UK, has made you even more appreciative of different perspectives, different cultures, different people, and the need just to move forward. And it's, well, so far, I'm absolutely loving this chat, Gina.
I'm glad that we can get away from the headlines, because, you know, quite often people go, oh, well, who is Gina Miller type thing? And all they know is, you know, the way that the language has been twisted and used as a weapon against me, be it in the media or by commentators. And, you know, it is not who I am, and, you know, and maybe we'll get onto it. But I've been a campaigner now for 30 years, and everywhere I've seen something that I think is unjust, I've spoken up. It's just, as you say, it's now in nature and nurture, probably a bit of both, because I can't remember ever being any different.
Yeah.
But it's just, it is who I am. I don't think about it. It's become, you know, this idea of being brave or being, I really find that difficult to understand.
Yeah.
Because I'm not doing anything that I think is brave. I just do things that are my nature. You know, I call it my pillow test. If I go to bed at night and I can sleep well when my conscience is light, because I know I've done my best that day for whoever I come across, wherever I've been. And if I don't, then it just bothers me and I just don't sleep well.
I completely get that. Absolutely get that, Gina. And there's something I can tell you that will relate to that when we play your next track, which is Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. What a wonderful track.
So, it is so great.
Share it with our audience as to why you've put this track in.
I think, well, you know, when you lead a very demanding professional life, you've just got to have something else that you do, your hobbies or something that allows you to relax. And for me, it's dancing, and it's just moving my feet. And what better song to do it to than this one?
Here we go. So enjoy this song, Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. So that was Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars, and I know it's a really, really upbeat song, but I'm now going to bring something in which isn't so upbeat, because Gina and I have been chatting, and you know, I was talking to her a little bit about my childhood. If you've listened to the show before, you'll know I've spoken about it before. I grew up with child abuse, and that made me very firm about being who I wanted to be rather than somebody else. And it seems that you and I have got something in common there, Gina, not from your childhood, but later in life. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So I was sort of a single mum and, you know, struggling, as most single mums do, sort of trying to go to university and look after my child, my eldest child who has special needs. And this supposedly wonderful man, charming, came into my life. But then turned out, once we got married, so it only changed once we got married, into an abuser, both physically and mentally. And after sort of 2-3 years, I was at such a depth of despair. I had no idea who I was anymore. He had managed to break me, my confidence, my belief in myself. I was just a rock bottom, and actually contemplating ending my own life, because he had manipulated me into such a place that I just felt as though I was drowning. And once you've experienced, and I talk about that because it's important that I think people, women and men, talk about their experiences, because your story, my story, can help those people who are feeling completely alone, completely isolated, and that nobody is ever going through what they're going through, and to show that actually you can survive, you can mm-hmm. walk away, and you can rebuild. So I tend to use the failings and the stories of my life to hopefully help other people to see their lives through a different lens. And, you know, one, after you go through an experience like that, like you say, it completely liberates you. I mean, you know, when people now abuse me or write things on social media, I think, you have no idea who I am, what I've survived. This is nothing. This is absolutely nothing.
Brilliant.
It doesn't affect me because, you know, I've been there and I've survived it. I've lived in a car with my eldest daughter when I had nowhere else to go. I went through a part of my life where I didn't have any money at all. And because he controlled everything. And when I ran away from him and from the marriage, I knew that he could track me if I ever used any credit cards or anything. So I just left with nothing. And, you know, there were days where I would make sure she would get something to eat and I would eat her leftovers, because it was better to be safe than for him to find out where I was. So, you know, I it's important that people know that, because they may see me now and think, oh, you know, she's successful, she's done this, that, and the other. Well, I have risen again from being at that low, but other people can do it too.
It's really fantastic. And I said to you at the start, Gina, I don't go and over-research people. I want a genuine conversation. I didn't know any of this. And it's wonderful because it also answers some other questions. And I'm just going to put it out there. You know, people who look at Gina Miller and they hear the way you speak, certainly compared to, you know, a Scouser from Toxteth like me, they might assume, look, how can she talk about anything? She's not a common person. She's got a plum in her mouth. But the other thing is that with regards to domestic abuse as well, people often think it belongs to a certain section of our society, and actually it's prevalent in all rungs of life.
But this is so interesting what you're saying, because when I said I would include it in my book and I'd write it, the chapter on this, and I'm very graphic and I talk about it a lot, and I talk about it, some of my close girlfriends said to me, Gina, you mustn't talk about this because people will think you're stupid, or they won't believe it, or you can't say it happens to women who are, you know, middle class. Well, nobody will believe you because people think domestic violence only happens to people, to stupid women. That's the word they used. And I remember looking at them and thinking, you're exactly what you said is why I must write this chapter. Because we need, you know, it's one of the last taboos, as far as I'm concerned, is domestic violence. That you don't realize that it's the physical side of it can be, is people get more used to, but the mental manipulation to break someone psychologically, it's like it's torture. Mental torture is almost worse than the physical, you know, because people see the physical and they react. When they don't see what's happening to you, what's happening inside your mind, when you think, it is that feeling that you are drowning and that you can't catch your breath and that you are going to be, you know, you'll just disappear and you can scream, but nobody's going to hear you. It's like you're going to scream and there's a silence and then you're forgotten. That is terrifying. To feel that way. And those are the sorts of things I wanted to share. And it's really important that we break these taboos.
Well, Gina, thank you very much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And I know that there'll be somebody listening who you're speaking to there more personally than anybody else that will also get it. So, next song, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. I got a bit emotional there, Gina, coming back to that. So tell me a little bit why why you chose Bohemian Rhapsody.
I mean, it's just such a glorious song, isn't it? And it was just because I've always been interested in not just music, but the people behind the music.
Yeah.
And I was obviously aware of Freddie Mercury. And because I was growing up not having many role models myself, I was curious about his background, mm-hmm. and I was curious about his story and the way he hid his color, and his ethnicity, and sort of had real, you know, couldn't come to terms with it in the world of popular music that he then ended up in. And so there was something in this song when it first came out. I knew it was revolutionary, it was avant-garde, it was innovative, but there was a pain in it as well. And I identified a little bit with that pain of that loneliness. And so to me, he'd almost written the song to me, which sounds ridiculous to say.
Wow.
But when I heard it, I felt he'd written it, and I knew I could identify with it on so many levels. So it was a very, very emotional song for me. I know now it's become very fashionable back. And what's interesting is I now have a little 11-year-old daughter, and she, out of no reason, and all the music they hear today, it's the song that she most loves on a really emotional level as well. So it's interesting for me to watch the way she receives that song. It's very much the way I received it.
Okay, let's play it. This is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Welcome back to the show. This is The Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture, and the people of the world. We've just been celebrating Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen with my wonderful guest today, Gina Miller. And as always, the further I've gone into this interview, the more I've seen things I want to question. So you and I were talking, Gina, about Freddie Mercury. Obviously, I know you look 21, but you've got a few years on me, not many. When that song came out, I was too young to realise what it was about. I didn't know that Freddie Mercury was of Indian descent, or was he of Pakistani or Indian descent?
His parents were mixed, so I think he was actually Indian.
Okay, but I didn't realise that until much later. Now, you told me he was racially abused and everything when he was a child, you know, by the other kids. And so that drove him to, to hide his identity. And, you know, at the moment, we've still got the same old problem, haven't we? We've got racism. I've noticed on social media the use of this term snowflake, which seems to mean I can insult you and if you get upset, you're a snowflake. It's very dismissive, really annoys me. I think that the people who are getting it most at the moment are trans people. They're really being marginalised. That's why last week I interviewed a transgendered lady. So, Gina, how do you see society going in this regard? I know you've got an opinion on it.
I'm really, really worried, and really, I'm not just worried, but I'm deeply sad about what's going on, because I think you have to be rational about what's going on. And I read and I hear, and it's told to me by so many politicians and commentators, oh, you know, things are getting much worse, there's much more racism, there's much more misogyny, there's much more of this. And I think I'm not quite convinced about that. What I think has changed is that we've always had these extreme voices. They've always been there, but they've been sort of, at the end of the bar in a pub, they've been in a room with maybe a few people. But social media has given them a platform where they can now amplify their voice, and you get other people who might think the same. They then press like or share, and suddenly it appears as though we're being taken over by division and discrimination and, all the disses, as you like. But I'm not sure about that. I think it's what's happening is those extreme voices are now becoming more part of our everyday conversations, mm-hmm. and they're not being shut down enough. They're not being shut down by media. They're not being shut down by the platforms. They're not being shut down by politicians. I mean, for me, myself, I am absolutely shocked that on, you know, numerous times a day, I'm told I have no right to speak up, that I'm just this colored woman. I should be grateful. I have this, you know, I should be grateful to be here and to be able to allow to speak. So why don't I be quiet and shut up? And the second thing is that I can't, as a woman of colour, you know, I can't be bright enough to be doing what I'm doing, that it must be men behind me sort of pulling my strings, you know, some sort of puppet masters. But this reference to animal, I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but there was a fourth-generation Viscount who was sent to prison, first time it's ever sort of, you know, such precedent and discrimination law. But he took out a Facebook ad and offered £5,000 for me to be beheaded, hunted like an animal, because I am an animal.
Oh, my God. Said,
and hunted and killed. You know, and I get that almost on a daily basis, those sorts of comments. This whole, you know, monkey, all these things that we thought had gone away, I thought had gone away, are now coming back again. And, you know, my even my son, as I said, I've got a 13-year-old son, he came home to me the other day, and he was very, you know, curious. He said, "Mum," I was walking down the road, and they were shouting, "Go home, go home." He said, "But where am I supposed to go home? I'm English. This is my home." And I say to him, and I say to, you know, anybody who I meet who's worried, and I say, you must never hide who you are. The color of the skin, the goodness in your heart, the intellect in your brain. You be who you are. You don't have to ever hide that. And I think that's really important that we all don't cower at this moment in time when there is this rising tide of discrimination and hatred.
Well said, Gina. Definitely well said. On that note, you have selected some classical music for us to play, and you know, when you first contacted me with this track, I was stunned because it's one of my favourites.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, Beethoven.
The whole piece, though. You have to listen to the long piece.
I do. Now, when I listen to classical music, I listen to the whole lot. And you know what? I've got no interest in becoming like in any way, shape or form knowledgeable about classical music. So I can listen to Italian opera without bothering to learn what the lyrics mean. Because you feel it, don't you?
And you feel
Beethoven has always been one of my favourites. I love the stringed instruments that often come into play, and I find his stuff is really passionate. Now, obviously, we're not going to be able to play the whole symphony in number 5. But here is a few minutes of Beethoven's 5th in C minor. Okay, so we haven't got time to play any more of Beethoven's 5th Symphony, but welcome back to the Culture Pot. I'm talking to Gina Miller. So we've spoken a lot about where you've come from, how life has developed for you. We've talked about your opinion and perspective on things. It's really been fascinating, Gina, so thank you for that. Let's talk about your professional life, because I know you do a number of things. You're an author, you're a campaigner, you've got a philanthropic, if that's the way you pronounce it, organisation.
Yes.
and you're also involved in making sure that financial services are working more honestly.
Well, I run an investment company. That's my big thing as well. So I actually run all the rest of the campaigning. Everything I do is sort of, believe it or not, in my spare time. So my main job is running an investment company. So but it's the same DNA that runs through everything I do. So when I wanted to be like my father, I wanted to be a criminal barrister.
Yeah.
So I started studying law. But this was the, you know, mid-80s in the UK. And there was a lot of discrimination against a woman of colour wanting to go to the bar. And I was being heavily advised by everybody that I should think about becoming a solicitor. And to me, that was sort of just this my thought. I wanted to be a barrister, and that was all my energy. So I took a year out because I was really, you know, deflated from the fact that I was not going to be able to fulfill this dream, that so many barriers and discrimination would be against me. So I took a year out, and which was a fascinating year because I traveled, I came across entrepreneurs, business people, artists, musicians. And I discovered that actually I wanted to explore the world of business. And I discovered as well that I had an ability to think of solutions, not just if there's a problem, but I actually have a clarity of thought when it comes to coming to a solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something I'm able to do. You know, we need to know ourselves and strengths and weaknesses. I have many, many weaknesses, but I know that's one of my strengths. So I decided that I would do a different degree for my law degree. So I then went and started a second degree, which was in marketing and business. And in the final year for my dissertation, I did a dissertation on financial services because it's behind every other industry. Long story short, I then in 1996 started, I still believe is one of the first specialist financial services marketing agencies in the UK. Launched a lot of businesses, sold that in 2002, and then more or less sort of retired and wanted to see what I could do next. And then I started looking at where we were as a society, the fact that there were so many pockets of deprivation that were being ignored. So I started doing a lot more philanthropic work. I started doing a lot more charitable work. I mean, I was involved in funding the Barnardo's project that led to Rochdale, to uncovering all the child abuse there. In Liverpool, your hometown, I worked there with a lot of young people who were not going to school and set up several projects to get them back into education. You know, I've been doing a lot of things, campaigning, trying to bring more transparency and more understanding, actually, to different sectors. So, you know, I'm, as my husband often says, I'm very good at making enemies because, you know, trying to stand up against some of the big self-interested charities has not made me friends. They don't like the transparency agenda I'm pushing in the third sector. In the investment sector, there's so many rip-offs that I knew led to the financial crisis that were not going to change. They'll just, you know, lovely words on websites and on brochures, but beneath the surface, nothing was going to change. So I started challenging the city to change its ways, and that's led to always going back to the law, because what I've found out is I did study a law. So using the law as a tool to enact social change or fairness is very powerful. So with that, I've been able to actually write text and influence three directives that come into the city that will change savers and investors' outcomes in pensions and investments and ISAs, et cetera. And that's how I run my company. So trying to completely disrupt the marketplace does not make you friends. But at the same time, I know I'm doing the right thing and I'm highlighting bad behavior and bad cultures. And, you know, there's a lot of, in all these areas, and you know this, there's a lot of conflicts of interest. There are a lot of people doing very well from other people's misery. And I just can't stand by and watch that.
I think that's really pertinent to some of the things that are happening now. And I'm going to come back to you with a question on that in a moment. For the moment, let's see how I do with this French. We're going to play your next track, which is La Fleur que tu m'avais jetée. From Carmen.
Carmen,
yeah. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
So it's the flower song. And
yes, by Bizet. Mm-hmm.
And you've chose this because you and your husband both love it.
I'm people often say I'm a really tough, hard person. I'm not. I'm pretty romantic, and this is such a beautiful romantic song. So if any men here listening who want to impress their partners, perhaps play them this song.
Great. Well, here it is. I'm not going to say it again, but it's from Carmen and it's Gina Miller's next track. So, Gina, what you were saying to me there about what you do, that, you know, you run an investment company, that you are disrupting the sector and you're disrupting how the third sector works as well. You're bringing more transparency. I can definitely relate with this, by the way, because I write for a lot of people and I've been working with somebody who runs a financial organisation. And he was talking, he's a beautiful man. His whole purpose is to give to the community. He generates wealth so he can give something back to the community. And when you write for somebody, you know, they've got to trust you. You get their heart. So I know this isn't spin. This is who he is. And I also sense that there's no reason for people to be greedy or selfish or cheat to make money. You can still work this system and be good. And this is what I want to get at. Some people, Gina, who are looking at you and, for example, your stance on Brexit, mm-hmm. some people might say, she's in this 1%. She's in this top 1%. Mm-hmm. And she's got her own reasons because mm-hmm. she's part of this big conspiracy. And I want you to dispel that myth.
If you go to the different hats I wear, so in the investment business that I run, our entire client base practically is the UK. I mean, Brexit will not touch our business one way or the other. So it absolutely has nothing to do with that. On the charity side, I underwrite all the costs of everything we do. And we give away as a family our money, because I do think there is a real problem with people who become wealthy and don't give back to the communities which help them to become successful or they came from. You know, if you look back to the Victorian philanthropists we led the world, to the British philanthropists, you know, Charles Dickens, to the Coots, to Lever Brothers, to, you know, Cadbury's. All of these were the great, great philanthropists and carers of the world, as it were, and communities. And that's what I think people should do with their money. You know, you can only, you know, I say to quite often when I tell you, I speak at lots of schools and young people, I say, look, you can have a home that's like a palace, but if you have to live in a compound and lock the door because then you walk out the front of it, people are sleeping on the streets, trees are dying, there's no joy in the world, what is the point? Mm-hmm. What is the point of living locked up in your refinery when everyone else is suffering? It doesn't make any sense. So I think one of the things I think you have to be very careful about when you're throwing stones to people who've been successful or who are seen as being this whole word elite, which I hate, because, you know, what does it mean? Elite in the English language means being the best of the best. It came from the Olympians. It's about sports, you know, and it's been poisoned as a word. But, you know, if you work hard, which I've done, I've not been given anything. I've worked 16-hour days. I still do now, practically. I've worked for everything I've got. So are we saying to young people, don't work hard, don't be successful, don't get money because then you're outcast. You have no right to speak. You're seen as a somehow untrustworthy, on a pedestal, that you are talked down at every opportunity. Is that what we're teaching our young people? Because why should they bother? But actually, if you're saying as I say, which is a term I use and I've been campaigning for a very long time, is what's called responsible capitalism, where we actually understand that we are all connected and we have that sense of collective responsibility, and that comes with our money and our wealth and our success as well as everything else, then the world would be a better place. And that's what I think I use my money to do. You know, I don't have to, all my campaigns are funded by my husband and I, or myself for Brexit. I mean, if people very generously give on crowdfunding or whatever, that's wonderful. But the majority of it, you know, be it my court case, I fund it myself, because I can't stand this idea that I have to, first of all, waste time with the begging bowl, because I haven't got time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to do. But also, if you take other people's money sometimes, especially from wealthy individuals or from corporations, you owe them and you have to toe their line. I want to be free to do what I believe is right and in other people's interest. I don't want to be held back by their self-interest. So I use my money to help the world, and that's what I'd always do. And I'm so privileged to have been lucky enough to be successful that I can do it.
Brilliant. Okay, Gina, there's lots of stuff there that resonates, which I can talk to you about off air, because we haven't got time to go into it on the interview itself. Okay. Let us go to your next track, which is Rehab by Jolly Boys. Do you want to say just a little bit about this before I play it?
Yeah, it's a wonderful song. I mean, most people will know, you know, the Amy Whitehouse version of Rehab. It's actually an old, old song. And the version, we had our honeymoon in Jamaica, and there's a part of Jamaica called Port Antonio, which is where Errol Flynn lived. And these young men in their mid-80s to sort of late 80s, called the Jolly Boys, are still singing and having fun, and they used to play. They were the mentor band for Errol Flynn all those years, decades ago. And I heard them play live this song, Rehab, and it was just so wonderful. It was, you know, and also showed me that even in your mid-80s, you can still have fun. You can have twinkle in your eye and just not be written off. They definitely aren't.
Brilliant. Here it is. Rehab. Okay, so that's always a brilliant track, that Gina, Rehab by the Jolly Boys. I've never heard that before until now. Certainly like Amy Winehouse's version. Unfortunately, we are reaching the end of the show, but we've got a few minutes to talk more about what other projects you're involved in now. Starting with, you have got a book, haven't you?
Yeah, so because I kept being approached to write a book on Brexit, and I thought, how boring. I don't want or the court case. I thought, I'm not going to write about that. But what I realized is, apart from all the horrible nastiness I get, I also get some letters that just bring me to tears, where people are feeling so desperate and so lonely, or so lacking confidence and lacking any sort of person that they think represents them, that I decided to write my memoirs. So it's using, if you like, it's a book about me failing. It's about the failures of my life, and through the lens of my life, helping hopefully other people to stand up and to carry on, and sharing the strategies and the lessons that I've learned. So it's called Rise, and it's about that rising up. And it's a book. It's using my life to hopefully help other people survive any sort of downside in their lives or any sort of failings in theirs. So it's a very, very personal book, very honest. I completely open my heart. I'm completely honest about everything that's happened to me in my life to date. It's there to help others. So hopefully, if someone wants to buy it and encourage their, especially young women, actually. I'm talking to young women who are finding it tough in this very strange world that we live in now, where everyone is being very fragile in their existence. And then politically, unfortunately, I thought Brexit would be ending up exactly in the state of chaos that it is at the moment, with very little time left. So I have a new campaign, which I started in September last year, called, ironically, End the Chaos. And it's a campaign, endthechaos.co.uk. And the main aim of it is that people are always asking me, what does this mean? We don't know where to get information from. Everything is twisted with a political sort of edge to it and exaggerated. We just want information that tells it as it is. And that's what we are. We are an open source, information-led, trying to help people guide through this chaos that we're seeing at the moment and give them some sense of understanding so they can be more informed. Because unless you understand and there's information, you just feel confused and depressed.
So when you say open source, does that mean that anybody can input verifiable information, whichever side of the Brexit equation they're on?
Yeah, exactly. So for example, on there's a page called Frequently Asked Questions. We don't populate that with anything we think people need to know about. People send us their questions and we'll answer them, or we'll get them online and we'll answer them. Reports from whoever, BMA have sent us reports saying they can't get it in the press. But, who wants to read 116 pages? So my team, we translate it down to sort of 9 to 8 understandable pages. If you want to write a blog, we'll check the sources, but you can blog on there. We will try and explain things. And we're not taking an inch. We're just trying to inform people.
Brilliant. And what else does the future hold for Gina then?
For me, my two really big campaigns in the future that I've already sort of very much advanced in talking about, not just in the UK but internationally, is this idea of responsible capitalism, that we move away from a single bottom line of profit to a triple bottom line of people, profit, and planet. mm-hmm. so that we have so the whole you know, let's reform capitalism, because, you know, trickle down economics has not worked. It has created, yes, has lifted millions of people out of poverty, but it's also created great divisions and a new class of poverty. So that's something I'm working on. And the other thing, not just because of Brexit, but what's happening around many countries, is to explore if there's something that sits between direct democracy and representative democracy. It's called deliberative democracy. And it's in its simplest form, it is, if you can imagine, a complicated form of jury service. So you have in areas, you have committees of ordinary citizens who sit for a year and help develop policy at a local level.
And what's that called again? What type of democracy?
Deliberative. So it's about thinking about things. And it's something that we need to explore more and more. It's more about local, not central.
Okay, Gina, that's really, really, it's been a great interview. If anybody needs to contact you, how do they get hold of you?
The best place to do it is at the campaign. So if you just send it to contact@endthechaos.co.uk, that always comes to me.
Lovely. Listen, thank you very, very much for taking the time out to talk to me today. And I know it's a pre-recorded show, but you said to me earlier on that, you know, you really weren't going to have the time, and you've been extremely generous. I can only assume that means you've enjoyed talking to me as
it's
much
been
as...
wonderful. It's a very different sort of interview. What's lovely about it is that it's not the usual questions. It's much more interesting. And I can tell from your voice and the way you ask your questions that you're really passionate about this. And I always like people with passion.
It's all about truth, isn't it, Gina? So do you want to say goodbye to our audience?
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I hope everyone listening to the Culture Pot enjoys this interview. And, you know, maybe read my book.
Thank you very much, Gina. So you've been listening to the Culture Pot on Radio Sangam on 107.9 FM. Today's guest has been Gina Miller. She's got a book out called Rise. And of course, she's done a few things to do with Brexit or not, as the case may be. So listen in next week when we'll be interviewing somebody else. Thank you for listening. Take care. Goodbye.